Almost immediately, rain sounded against the truck's roof. It obscured vision through the windshield. Turning on the ignition but not the engine, Fletch sent the wipers over the windshield every few minutes. At 8:15, he saw the grill of the Rolls-Royce in the driveway opposite. It had been Fletch's plan to pull the truck further back into the woods if he had forewarning of Horan's departure. He had had none. He hoped the combination of the rain and the screen of brush in front of him protected him somewhat from being seen. The Rolls did not stop. It turned right, without hesitation, back the way it had come the night before. After Horan went around the curve, Fletch extricated the truck from the bushes and followed him. He followed him back to 60 Newbury Street. Fletch was parked, halfway down the block, before the manservant opened the garage in response to Horan's horn. The Rolls backed across the sidewalk into the garage. It was 9:10 Saturday morning. At 9:15, Fletch drove to the pharmacy. There he bought a razor, a blade, and a can of shaving foam. He also bought a cup of tea to go. In the truck, he loosened his collar, threw out the tea bag, and using the tarpaulin, as well as the razor, the blade, the shaving foam, and the tea, shaved himself. At 9:30, he rang the doorbell of the Horan Gallery. Chapter 21. The Picasso was on the easel in Horan's office.
Ah, good morning, Mr. Fletcher. Wet morning.
Afraid I came away without my raincoat. The weather would take the blame for his disheveled appearance. Hard to get a taxi in the rain. Always, sympathized the impeccable Ronald Horan.
Well, there it is.
Fletch had stopped in front of the painting. Damned fool title, but what could the painting be called but Vino Viola Mademoiselle? The basic shape was repeated 3 times. The first image, or the fourth, was the true shape. Magnificent, he said.
I believe I can guarantee its authenticity.
I'm speechless, Fletch said.
I'm curious as to why you want to purchase this piece in particular. I'm always curious about that.
I saw a slide of it, Fletch said, at a little showing in Cannes, sometime well after Picasso's death. It just sped by with a lot of other slides. It struck me as possibly the key Cubist work, even more refined than others of the same theme. Horan was looking at the painting as well.
You may be right, he said.
But let's not tell Mr. Cooney. Fletch walked around the easel. It's all right, it arrived without damage.
No damage at all.
Horan joined him behind the painting.
And I may add, I believe this is the original stretcher, although it may not be.
You picked it up at the airport yourself? Horan moved to the front of the painting.
I rather indicated to Mr. Cooney we'd be in touch with him sometime early today. Although we needn't be, of course, it's up to you.
What's your advice?
You might start with $650,000.
Fletch wandered to a chair from which he could see both Horan and the painting.
You say Mr. Cooney is not an active collector?
Well, he's not in the business of collecting, Horan answered. I've bought one or two other things from him in the last year or two. They've always proven to be right.
You've bought 2 other paintings from him within the last 2 years?
As I say, the man doesn't have a professional reputation to uphold, as a dealer would have or a museum, but his other sales, at least through this gallery, have been entirely successful. Tall, slim, suave, graying Horan prowled the rug, arms behind his back in an attitude of respectful waiting. Quietly, firmly, Fletch said, I'm interested in the painting's provenance.
Ah!
Horan responded as if a whole new topic had been introduced, an original question from a slow student.
I'm not sure you'll be entirely satisfied there.
No.
You see, in many private sales, provenance is not offered.
The man was lecturing again.
Especially in a case of this sort. There is no record of this painting in existence, at least none I've been able to find. Of far more importance, there appears to be no record of this painting's ever having left another country, or ever having entered this country. Governments, with their taxes and other requirements, their increasing interest in preserving national cultural objects, these days, you know, could be a bit sticky.
I know. Which, of course, makes my having the provenance of this painting all the more important.
Yes, I can see that.
You live in Italy, don't you?
I sometimes do. Of course, we can ask Mr. Cooney the provenance. You haven't done so? I know what he'll say. Let me guess, said Fletch. He'll say he bought it from a reputable dealer in Switzerland sometime in the past, and he doesn't remember precisely when. Well, yes. Horan was pleased by the slow student's perceptive answer. I expect that's what he would say. There are more reputable art dealers in Switzerland than there are citizens of France. Piled on top of each other, they are that nation's national culture. As I guess you know, Swiss dealers seldom confirm sales. But I think we should ask Mr. Horan. By all means, we should. I wish to know the source and the history of this painting. Of course, when a provenance isn't offered, Mr. Fletcher, I would be derelict in not asking for the provenance. You said you represent yourself. I would be derelict in my obligations to myself, my estate, as well as to those parts of the art world which consider their responsibilities. Frankly, I'm fairly shocked you cannot say you've already asked for a complete provenance. Below Horan's silver-streaked temples appeared a flush of red. I don't think you understand, Mr. Fletcher, how usual this situation is. Very common indeed. Art is the international language. It is also an international currency. The art market, by its nature, is international. It cannot recognize arbitrary national borders. Governments have been poking more and more into matters which are beyond their natural province. People must insist upon privacy in their affairs, especially in aesthetic matters. Ah, yes. You remember, I'm sure, the deluge of art objects flooding out of Britain in late 1975 as a result of incredible legislative mistakes by the Labour government. Were you unsympathetic? I understood the movement. Incidentally, it is entirely possible Vino Viola Mademoiselle is one of those objects of art which found its way here from Britain. It's also possible it's not. In any case, even if it is, I must protect myself, Mr. Horan. My dear Mr. Fletcher, you are protected. Entirely protected. We are not new in this business. After spending a little more time with this painting, I'm sure I will have no hesitation in authenticating it. If you wish a second authentication, or even a third, such can be arranged locally within a matter of days, if not hours. Very good of you. You will have bought the painting through the Horan Gallery in Boston with proper authentication. My reputation has never been questioned. If asked, which I doubt I would be, I will state happily the seller is James Cooney of Dallas, Texas. When asked, he in turn... We'll say he bought it sometime in the past from a reputable dealer in Switzerland, Fletch said. And the reputable dealer in Switzerland will refuse to come forward with the record, which is his right as a Swiss citizen. Bless the Swiss, said Horan. They still have some sense of privacy left, although it is dissipating. I understand all this, Mr. Horan. In the meantime, and forever, your investment is absolutely protected. It remains my obligation to ask the question. I want to know where Cooney got the painting, even if it is in the nature of private, undocumented information. Yes, of course, you're right, Mr. Fletcher. We should ask the question. In the meantime, would you care to mention a specific price to Mr. Cooney? Horan stepped behind his Louis XVI desk to answer the telephone. The ring had been muffled. Hello? Yes, this is Mr. Horan. Who wishes to speak to me? Hello? No, operator, no. I will accept no calls from anyone in Chicago today. This is the third call I've had from the Chicago Tribune. I have already denied that story. What's your name? Mr. Potok? Two others of your reporters have already called here this morning, Mr. Potok. How many times do I have to deny a story? I am not giving, nor have I ever intended to give, a painting to the Chicago Museum. What do you mean, what painting am I not going to give? My God, I have no idea where the Boston newspaper got the story. I believe it was the Star. I haven't read the story. I expect it was their idiot critic, Charles Wainwright, who has never gotten anything right. Listen, Mr. Potok, I am not giving a painting to the Chicago Museum. I never intended to give a painting to the Chicago Museum. I never will give a painting to the Chicago Museum. What do you mean? I have nothing against the Chicago Museum. Mr. Potok, I'm running out of patience. The story is entirely fallacious. Please don't call here again. His footfalls on the rug repeated the quiet firmness with which he had hung up the phone. Some damn fool Boston newspaper reported I'm going to give a painting to the Chicago Museum. Horan shook his head. Totally untrue. Where do they get things like that? There's no accounting for the press, said Fletch. We were discussing price. Fletch stood. He remembered he didn't have a coat. Yes, we were, said Fletch. I think we might offer Mr. Cooney $275,000. Horan looked slapped. That would be totally unacceptable. I know. I'll go higher, of course. But tell Mr. Cooney I am deeply anxious about the source of this painting. I doubt he'll talk in response to such an offer. He might talk. A lot. Chapter 22. Who's there? The big bad pomegranate. It was 11:30 Saturday morning. Fletch had had to go a little out of his way to find a hardware store on his way home from Newbury Street. He had bought a screwdriver, a pair of pliers, and a small can of household oil, all of which he had left in the truck. After putting the truck in the River Street garage, he had cut through the alley and up the iron cement-walled back stairs to his apartment. He had forgotten Mrs. Sawyer would be there. Naturally, she had locked the back door. "You go away," she shouted through the door. "Nothing gets picked up on Saturdays." "It's Mr. Fletcher, Mrs. Sawyer. Please open up." "What are you doing out there?" The two bolts slid free of the door. "Well, look at you," she said. "Out caterwauling all night? Where's your coat? You're wet like a puppy." "Good morning." "You have a European countess sleeping in your own bed, and you're not even home to enjoy it."
"In my bed?"
"She calls herself the Countess del Gassi."
"She should."
"I've never seen so much luggage. She expect to be buried here?"
"She slept in my bed."
"Didn't you leave her there?"
"I did not. Where is she?"
"She said something about going shopping. Then she said something about going to the museum and visiting some galleries."
"Great. I fed her and she's gone.
Mercy, Lord, was she hungry. You'd think no one had fed her in a month."
"No one has."
The bright white kitchen was a complete contrast to the cold, dark, wet truck.
"I'm wet."
"Your hair looks like you spent the night tunneling through a haystack. Maybe that's what you were doing. You want something to eat?"
"Sure would. Where are the Countess's things?"
"You'll see, all over the apartment. I never met such a bossy woman. She talked to me like I was a platoon."
"Would you move everything of hers into a guest room, please, then close the door tight?"
"I'm not sure it'll all fit. You want breakfast or lunch?"
"Anything warm would be great. By the way, where are the telephone books?"
After standing in a warm shower, he sat on the edge of his bed and checked all the local telephone books. There was no listing for Lucy Connors. However, there was a listing on Fenton Street in Brookline for Marcia Hauptmann. He dialed the number and waited through four rings. "Hello? Hello, this is Martin Head of Tray Magazine. Is Ms. Connors there?"
Fletch guessed it was Ms. Hauptmann, who said, "Just a moment, please."
Another voice came on the line. "Hello? Ms. Connors, this is Martin Head of Tray Magazine. I've been trying your number all week."
"Yes?"
"Ms. Connors, I'd appreciate your listening very carefully to what I have to say and see if you can't agree to it."
"I doubt I will."
"Please, you'll see our intention is good, and with your cooperation, the result may be good."
"You've got me mystified. I don't read your magazine."
"We would like to do a sensitive, personal story, without mentioning any names or using any photographs, on women who have declared themselves lesbian, especially after having gone through a few years of married life."
"Where did you get my name?"
"Your husband."
"Bart's in Italy. I can't believe that."
"We met him Tuesday night in Montreal. Apparently he's far more understanding, or trying to be far more understanding, than many husbands in similar circumstances we've met."
"Bart? I suppose so."
"I believe you could give our readers some genuinely sensitive insights into what you've been through. Some real understanding. You'd be an ideal interview."
"I don't think so. Is it Mr. Head?"
"Martin."
"Does this have anything to do with the murder?"
"What murder?"
"There was a murder in my husband's apartment the other night. I wouldn't want to comment on it. It's perfectly irrelevant."
"I didn't know about that."
Fletch's eyes wandered around Lucy and Bart Connors' old bedroom.
"If it's irrelevant, why should it be mentioned?"
"I don't think so, Martin. This has been bad enough without publicity."
"Lucy, think how bad it is for other women in the circumstances you were in. I dare say you felt pretty alone going through it."
"Certainly did."
"It sometimes helps to be able to read that someone else has been through it. You've resolved your problems fairly successfully, I gather."
"You're a very convincing fellow, Martin."
"Furthermore, I guarantee you there will be no personal publicity.
You'll be referred to as Ms. C., period. Nice, tasteful drawings, probably abstracts, will be made up as illustrations.
And what if you don't?
You can sue us. We know we're trespassing here on personal, intimate affairs. We're doing a story on your feelings rather than the facts. We're not out to expose anybody or anything.
I see. Would you let me read the story and okay it before it's published?
We don't like to do that. The editors sort of feel that's their job.
I won't talk to you unless I see the story before it's published.
Fletch forced himself to hesitate.
Okay, Lucy, I agree. It will have to be between us, but I'll let you see the story before I hand it in. When can I see you?
Marsh and I are going shopping this afternoon if this rain ever lets up, and we're seeing friends tonight.
May I come tomorrow morning?
Okay. About 10?
10:30. 58 Fenton Street?
Apartment 42.
Will Ms. Hauptmann be there?
You bet. You goof up one little bit, babe, and we'll both stomp on you.
Chapter 23.
After steak and eggs, provided and prepared by Mrs. Sawyer, Fletch got into his freshly made bed with yesterday's edition of the Boston Star. The murder of Ruth Fryer received little space compared to the space devoted to the city councilperson's murder. Obviously, there was no new news concerning Ruth Fryer's murder. The city councilperson's murder was reported in the greatest detail, together with her full biography, with pictures of her throughout her career, a personal recollection piece by the paper's chief local reporter, a sidebar of quotes from notables, political and non-political, friends and enemies, all conspicuously generous. She was a jowly, mean-eyed woman. Indeed, she must have been an unpleasant sight, bloody in her bath. After more than an hour, Fletch saw an advertisement for an Alec Guinness matinee double bill, The Lavender Hill Mob and The Man in the White Suit. It was the right thing to do on a rainy Saturday afternoon. According to his map, the theater was not far. While he was dressing in slacks, loafers, open shirt, sweater, and tweed jacket, he heard the door buzzers ring and presumed it was some enterprise of Mrs. Sawyer. She was trying to restock the kitchen shelves. Coming down the corridor, then, he was surprised to see Inspector Flynn in the hall. His Irish-knit sweater made his chest and shoulders look even more huge, his head even more minute.
"Ah," Flynn grinned amiably. "I was hoping you'd be at home."
He was carrying a package which was clearly a bottle of something.
"Where's Grover?" Fletch asked, coming into the hall. He took Flynn's outstretched hand.
"I have some time of my own, you know," Flynn said. "The department lets me off the leash sometimes on the weekend. Had to come nearby, wanted to pick up a Schoenberg score the store doesn't have in yet, and happened to consider the city of Boston owes you a bottle of whiskey."
He presented his package with the full joy of giving.
"That's damned nice of you."
It was 12-year-old Pinch.
"Hope I'm not disturbing anything."
"Oh, no, I was just going to see a couple of Alec Guinness pictures at the Exeter Street Theater. That's nearby, isn't it?"
"What a darling man. He's Irish, you know. Most English people you think of with talent are."
He rubbed his hands together.
"I thought it'd be a rainy Saturday afternoon. You might like to sit with me over a taste."
"I thought you never touched the stuff."
"I never do. But like work itself, I never mind watching another man partake."
He turned to Mrs. Sawyer.
"I don't suppose you keep a chamomile tea?"
She said, "I think we got red zinger."
"Any herb tea will do. Perhaps you'd bring a glass, some ice and water, into the study as well for Mr. Fletcher here."
The thing seemed decided. Flynn stepped into the den. Fletch snapped on the lights and began to open the odd-shaped bottle. Flynn rummaged around inside his sweater, having driven his hand through the neck of it, and pulled two sheets of folded paper from his shirt pocket.
"I was able to secure the complete passenger list for Flight 529 from Rome last Tuesday."
He handed it to Fletch, who put down the open bottle.
"I wonder if you'd cast your eye along that and see if there are any names you know."
"You think Ruth Fryer's murder might have something to do with something I was doing in Rome, eh?"
"Mr. Fletcher, you said yourself people hate you all over the world. Surely one might spend an airfare to wreak your undoing."
Most of the names on the list were Italian. Most of the rest were Irish, modern-day pilgrims on a flight between Rome and America in search of spiritual consolation or material attainment. Flynn stood, hands in his pockets, chin back, the amiable grin still on his face.
Supposing we were friends, Mr. Fletcher, he said. What would I call you? Surely not Irwin Maurice. Are you used to the name Peter yet? Or are you down to calling yourself Pete?
Fletch, Fletch said. People call me Fletch.
Fletch, is it? Now that's an impudent enough name. Couldn't an Irish poet dance a maypole playing with a name like that, though?
I recognize no one's name on the list.
Fletch handed it back to him.
I was afraid you'd say that. And I should call you Francis Xavier, right?
People call me Frank, said Flynn, except my wife, who calls me Franny. She has a kindlier, softer view of me.
Mrs. Sawyer entered with a tray.
I had the hot water on anyway, she said.
On the tray were an ice bucket, an empty glass, a water carafe, a teapot, cream, sugar, a cup, saucer, spoon.
Ah, that's lovely.
Flynn rubbed his hands again.
Tell me, Mrs. Sawyer, when you left here after cleaning up Monday night, was there water in the carafe in the living room next to the whiskey bottle?
No, sir. Of course there wasn't. That had been washed out, dried out, and stoppered.
I wouldn't think so. Who'd leave water out to go stale when it's so easily replaceable? Was the whiskey bottle there when you left?
What whiskey bottle? Which whiskey bottle?
There was more than one.
There were a lot of bottles on that table. That was Mr. Connors's little bar. There were scotch bottles, bourbon bottles, gin bottles, sherry and port decanters. Plenty of clean glasses.
What happened to them?
Mr. Fletcher put them away. I found them all in a cupboard in the kitchen. I figured he couldn't stand the sight of such things any more than I can.
Flynn looked his question at Fletch.
No, Fletch said, I didn't.
And, Flynn asked Mrs. Sawyer, I suppose you've been rummaging around in that cupboard, touching the bottles and thus obliterating any fingerprints which might have been on them.
Of course I've been touching the bottles. I've been shoving them back and forth. They've been in the way of the sugar, salt, and pepper.
The sugar, salt, and pepper. A most active cupboard.
No use, said Flynn.
Thank you, Mrs. Sawyer.
You want anything else, you just let me know, she said. I'm so far behind on my own work, I have no hope of finishing anyway.
Sal to the earth, said Flynn, pouring out his tea. Sal to the earth.
Across the hall, the kitchen door swung shut.
Of course, it's always the sal to the earth that destroys the evidence.
They sat in the red leather chairs, two men in sweaters, one in a jacket as well, one with a cup of tea, the other with a scotch and water. Through the light curtains of the long windows was a dark sky. Every few moments, a gust of wind from the Boston Gardens splattered a sheet of rain against the windows. From six stories below, they could hear the hiss of tires going along Beacon Street.
A dark, gloomy day like this, said Flynn, reminds me of when I was a boy in Munich, growing up. Dark days indeed.
Munich?
Let's see, on a day like this, a rainy fall Saturday afternoon, I'd be obliged to be in the gymnasium. The real gymnasium, the sports place. Doing push-ups, scrambling up ropes, wrestling until the blood was ready to burst our heads.
You're Irish?
That I am. Or we'd be out running miles in the wet around the countryside, looking out for the little red markers, sweat and rain mixed on our faces, the air heavy in our lungs, the ground just turning hard beneath our feet. What a splendid way to bring a boy up. No doubt I owe my current hardy constitution to it.
To what?
I was a member of the Hitler Youth.
You what?
Ah, yes, laddie. A man has many things in his past.
The Jugendführer?
You've got it just right, laddie. How is that possible?
As you've said yourself, anything is possible.
Is this whiskey all right?
Very good, said Fletch.
Not being a drinking man myself, I'm shy in making choices for others. I'm afraid it was the peculiar shape of the bottle that caught my eye.
It's fine.
I don't suppose one should buy the whiskey for the bottle.
One might as well.
For all you drink, you mean. I see you're not a gulper.
Not in front of you, anyway.
How could Francis Xavier Flynn be a member of the Jugendführer? Now, haven't I asked myself that same question 1,000 times?
I've just asked you again.
The Republic of Ireland, of course, had little to do with the war. Relentlessly neutral, as they say, on the side of the Allies. My Da was the Republic's counsel to Munich. Is it getting clearer?
No.
In 1938, when I was about 7 years old, it was decided, because of the unusual world circumstances, that I would stay on in Munich with my parents instead of returning home to school by myself, as would have been normal. I spoke German as well as any boy my age, had had my first years in German schools, looked and dressed German, and as my Da said, entrusting me with this great responsibility, I had reached the age of reason. So my Da took up agreeing with the Nazis in public, although he hated their ideas as any decent man would. We remained in Germany throughout the war. I remained in the German school, became a member of the Hitler Youth. The shirt pants, the neckerchief, the salute, the whole thing. Marched in the rallies. Was the young star at some of the gymnastic shows. People forgot I was Irish altogether. Flynn, really. Believe it if you will. I was a perfect member of Jugendfuhrer. But you know, you'd be surprised what a wee boy in short pants and a Hitler Youth shirt and a bicycle and a camera can do. He can roam the countryside, sometimes with his friends. Tours of installations would be set up for us. You'd be amazed how soldiers and officers will show things to a wee boy they wouldn't show their own mothers. Anything I didn't understand, I'd take a picture of. Any time I came across what I suspected was a Nazi dignitary, I'd get his autograph. You'd be surprised at the number of high Nazi officers who'd be moving about in great secrecy but would stop to sign their names on a slip of paper for a small boy. Ah, I was a wonder, I was. And I had a couple of friends I corresponded with all during these years in Dublin. One was Timmy O'Brien, Master Timothy O'Brien, and the other was Master William Cavanaugh. I used to write them excited letters about my life, where I'd been and what I'd seen. I was full of the old Nazi malarkey, a bragging schoolboy I was, if you read the letters. Sometimes I'd get letters back, doubting my word. I'd send photographs and autographs, and every proof I had. Of course, my Da was the ghostwriter of my side of the correspondence. And both Masters O'Brien and Cavanaugh had their actual address in London, at headquarters for British intelligence. My God. An unusual way to grow up. My father also was using the consulate to help sneak British and American flyers out of the country home again. It was all very difficult on my mother. Is this true, Flynn? I was 14 at the end of the war. Munich was rubble. There was no food to be had. Well, I expect you've seen the pictures. It's all true. Before the Nazis withdrew, they shot my parents. Each of them. A single bullet between the eyes. In the kitchen of our apartment. I don't think the Nazis had any evidence against them. I think it was one of those arbitrary murders. There were lots of such incidents those days. I found them after standing an air raid watch. What did you do then? Oh, there were weeks and months to go yet. At first I lived with the family of a friend. They didn't have any food or heat either. I was on the street, living under things that had already fallen down. Even after the surrender, there were weeks and weeks of wandering around. You see, I was afraid to go up to the British or American soldiers. An odd thing. I was afraid of them. Of course, I was half crazy. One night, sleeping in an alley, I got the toe of a boot between my ribs. Someone spoke to me in the lilt. A soldier was standing over me. You can believe he got an earful of Irish like he'd never had. Then it was home for me back to Dublin. I was put in a Jesuit seminary, if you'd believe it. I guess it was my choice. I'd seen hell, you see. I learned another logic, got my health back. By the age of 20, I was tired of truth. Can you understand that? Of course. The celibacy had worn thin, too. So I wrote a friend of mine, Master William Cavanaugh, in London. I sent the letter direct this time, asking for a job. I gather the letter caused a great laugh among the old boys. The rest of my life is a blank. I know you didn't work in Chicago. I know you know that. You did work in Chicago. What were you doing at the newspaper the other day if you weren't inquiring about me?